A tale of two governors, one trying to hold on, the other trying to come back. New York's Andrew Cuomo saying he's not going anywhere despite a growing threat of impeachment and a public call from President Biden to resign. And 12 plus years after his own impeachment and after 8 years in prison, Rod Blagojevich is taking his state to court to fight for the chance to run for office again. He joins me live and in studio. And later, the godfather of soul, James Brown, died on Christmas Day 2006. So why did it take 15 years and a state Supreme Court ruling to finally settle his estate? Two of his daughters take us inside the family and legal drama tonight on Banfield.
I want you to know directly from me that I never touched anyone inappropriately or made inappropriate sexual advances.
That's New York Governor Andrew Cuomo defending himself by denying pretty much everything he's accused of in a searing report out today from New York's Attorney General. Hello and welcome to Banfield. I'm Adrienne Bankert in tonight for Ashley. After months of investigation, the AG's office found Cuomo sexually harassed no fewer than 11 women in recent years, most of them current or former state employees. In one case, Cuomo allegedly retaliated against an accuser who went public. Hours later, President Biden publicly called on Cuomo to resign. And the Speaker of the New York State Assembly says the report from that incident indicates that someone being Cuomo, is not fit for office. So we welcome our guest for tonight. Beth Fagan is a lawyer who specializes in representing survivors of sexual assault and sexual harassment. Thank you for being with us. And also Lauren Leader is co-founder and CEO of the nonpartisan women's leadership group All In Together. She's also a city councilwoman in Harrison, New York. Ladies, thank you so much for being here. Beth, I want to start with you. You represented a number of women in the Harvey Weinstein trial and in New York particularly. This case, a lot of times, I think, to the public, can be coupled with all of the high-profile cases we've seen, but there are distinct differences. Why don't you break those down for us?
Yeah, absolutely. So what we see today in the report that was released is that a number of women have come forward that worked directly in Governor Cuomo's office. They had an employment relationship. And so what we see is this kind of daily harassment of words, of touching, that creates a hostile work environment that is different than rape or the types of things that we see in the Harvey Weinstein case.
Absolutely. I mean, obviously, we don't want to minimize the trauma of these women who went through what they say they went through. But again, these are serious charges, especially for such a high-ranking official. Lauren, I know that you and Gretchen Carlson, a famous name in the news, co-authored an op-ed, and that it was important for you to call on your fellow Democrats to be accountable or to call on accountability for people and cases just like this one. Why was that important for you to make a statement about?
Right. And we made that statement back in March when the allegations first surfaced against the governor. There are a long list of reasons. First of all, if you are elected to hold high office in this or in any state, you should be held to an exceptionally high standard of behavior. And creating a workplace that is hospitable, positive, and equitable for all is a fundamental, basic obligation of any leader in any position, whether that's in business or in politics. Secondly, in order for the governor to continue to govern effectively, he has to have the confidence of his own party. He has to have a certain kind of moral authority, especially as the lead Democrat in the state, because Democrats are the core principles of Democratic leadership in New York are meant to be inclusion, women's rights, equity. And it's impossible to represent those things if you've been credibly accused by multiple women of harassment, as he has. And, you know, this is not, it is the harassment issue. It is also hostile work environment. These are all issues that have been drilled into every New York State employee and, frankly, every employee of almost any institution for years. Everybody understands that this is unacceptable workplace behavior, except apparently Governor Cuomo.
Well, I want to address the fact that this could be another case of he said, she said, or they said. And Beth, I know this is very important because you've actually worked with Attorney General Letitia James, and you've worked with her team, rather. And so for them to take this case on and to have an independent investigation, how important is this in making a case against Andrew Cuomo?
I think it's so important because it reflects that it's not politicized. Here, the Attorney General's office retained two outside law firms who had full reign to do any type of investigation they wanted. And what they did was not just speak to the women or Governor Cuomo, but look at the contemporaneous evidence of the harassment. So, for example, if a woman sent a text message after something happened to a friend and said, oh my gosh, you won't believe what just happened to me. They looked at all of that to ensure that this wasn't a case of he said, she said, but that there was contemporaneous objective evidence that these things occurred.
And you mentioned the text message. That is actually part of this case, correct? There was a woman who had text messages from I don't know how far back, and she said, oh my gosh, look what happened. I'm sending this to my girlfriend, and it was it damning?
Absolutely. There were not only text messages, other women sent emails, and frankly, some of these were witnessed by other people who came forward and corroborated what happened. These were on-the-job events, particularly, for example, someone was part of his protective services, and other policemen or policewomen witnessed this and testified to it.
It's interesting because the governor's attorney released a statement. The New York Times actually featured this in one of their articles, repeatedly saying that he is innocent. And not only that, calling out each individual woman's claims and saying, this is really what happened. In fact, in one case, the governor's attorney says that the governor actually was accused of using a humidor in his office that he was showing to an employee. And the woman accidentally, or not accidentally, but the woman mistakenly thought that he was making some reference to Monica Lewinsky. And so she took that as a form of harassment when he said, I've showed a lot of people this particular humidor. So, Lauren, I'm asking you, is there a possibility that in some of these cases, there is a lot of miscommunication? And even with a hostile work environment claims, that it's possible that there is a hypersensitivity, especially during high pressure, intensely stress-filled jobs like this one?
Well, first of all, the statement that was released by the attorney for the governor is dozens of pages long, and it came out just a few hours ago. They clearly had been preparing this well in advance of the report. They were prepared to deny an attack, regardless of what the report said. And they had tried to paint this report as somehow political, which I think is ridiculous. The Attorney General of the state of New York did absolutely everything possible to create a fair process, frankly, a more fair and comprehensive process than the vast majority of harassment victims ever get the benefit of, or frankly, those who have been accused. In most cases, they're subject to forced arbitration in a secret environment and adjudicated by a company that has something to gain. So, you know, the fact is that the governor was unwilling to take personal responsibility for any of this. He has used every excuse in the book to try to cover up his appalling behavior. There is a reason why everyone in New York politics of significant, holding significant office, up to the president of the United States, of his own party, has now called on him to resign. This was credible. It has now been well documented. It is virtually irrefutable. And whether or not the governor wants to acknowledge his own behavior, the rest of the world has. And at some point, he's going to need to catch up to the fact that he's wrong. He's just wrong. And there are very few friends on his side at this point who think that's not the case.
Well, you know, you mentioned friends. His friends are like, you know, the Speaker of the House. Nancy Pelosi is one of his friends, and she's calling on him to step down. Let's listen. I want to listen to a soundbite from the Attorney General herself speaking about this. Can we play that, guys?
These interviews and pieces of evidence reveal a deeply disturbing yet clear picture. Governor Cuomo sexually harassed current and former state employees in violation of both federal and state laws. This investigation has revealed conduct that corrodes the very fabric and character of our state government and shines light on injustice that can be present at the highest levels of government.
And again, this was based on the findings of an independent investigation. Lauren, I have to call on you again to ask what your take is. Obviously, Democrats in New York are looking at this. They are the sole body responsible for impeachment if it indeed goes to that level. Do you think, let's just call it a long shot, by some means, you know, he's found that he's not guilty. Okay, we're just going to imagine. Would it be possible for Democrats to say, okay, we stand behind you again? Or has the trust been completely broken? I mean, either way, is it already too far, too much, too far for the governor?
I think so. I mean, you've got the Speaker of the New York State Senate, who's very powerful, Andrew Stewart Cousins, as well as Carl Heastie, the Speaker of the Legislature, who have both said that he needs to go. They have the power to whip the vote, I believe, to impeach him. The fact is that the governor had eroded the confidence of many in the state legislature and the state Senate even before this. He doesn't have a lot of good political will to stand on. And while he definitely sees himself as having a strong base of support in the state, he held very high dollar fundraisers recently, has been indicating that he's going to run for office again. He's going to face an absolute avalanche of opponents running against him. He actually came very close to losing in the last two election cycles against not especially well-known opponents. And when he was stronger than he is now, and you know, whether the legislature follows through with the impeachment, it is very hard to know. They're not in session right now. It's going to take some time. But this is a man who is a man alone. He is an island in and of himself. He has been before, but he really is now. And it is such a disservice to the people of New York that he is unwilling to set aside his ego and step aside, by the way, which would allow the first woman governor to be appointed in the state's history, Kathy Hochul, who has been a tireless advocate for women. If he had the best interest of the state in mind, he would step aside and let the next governor do the people's business undistracted from this avalanche of accusation and broken laws.
Yeah, you're talking about the lieutenant governor, the current serving lieutenant governor, who would step into his place. Let's watch a soundbite from Governor Cuomo in his own words, defending himself earlier today.
I want you to know directly from me that I never touched anyone inappropriately or made inappropriate sexual advances. I am 63 years old. I've lived my entire adult life in public view. That is just not who I am. And that's not who I have ever been.
There are a lot of families just like this at home who have very handsy or touchy-feely relatives. Kissing and touching faces and embracing is a common part of life in and out of the home. Whether he is guilty or innocent, there are a lot of feelings surrounding this kind of behavior. So, Beth, I want to turn it to you. Whether it's cultural or generational, what the governor said today is something that a lot of people at home are likely thinking about.
You know, men have been hiding behind this idea that they come from old-fashioned values and that it's okay to call women honey. But if you're the governor, you hold the top position in New York, you're not allowed to use that as a shield. And I think what's really important here is this idea that he had a network surrounding him who were receiving complaints as they went and weren't reporting them to the proper office, were covering them up, were moving women out of their positions. And to me, that's indicia that there was a problem here. This wasn't something that no one else knew about. The people around him knew about it and they covered it up.
And now he really could seriously face not only criminal charges in at least one county in New York, but also impeachment, which won't happen immediately. We've done some research. That's going to take some time, but we'll find out what's next. Beth, thank you to you. Also, Lauren, we appreciate you joining us virtually and live. Straight ahead, it's one thing to be impeached. It's another to be prosecuted, convicted, and sent to federal prison. But Rod Blagojevich wants to put that all behind him.
It was a corrupt impeachment process. It was unconstitutional. It violated my due process rights and violated the due process rights of the people of Illinois.
The former governor joins me live with his plans to return to public life, beginning with one very uphill court fight. That's next. Welcome back. Former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich got his life back a year and a half ago when President Trump, generally no friend of blue state Democratic governors, commuted his prison term for corruption. Corruption that included trying to sell Barack Obama's former Senate seat. Now, Blagojevich wants his career back. This week, he announced a long-shot federal lawsuit that seeks to throw out the unanimous votes of the Illinois Senate that ousted him in 2009 and barred him from future public service in the state of Illinois. Rod Blagojevich joins us right now, live in studio. Thank you so much for being here with us.
Thanks, Adrian. Nice to be here.
Yeah, nice to see you. And, you know, really, I got to ask you about Governor Cuomo's situation, because while the cases are completely different, different circumstances, you know what it's like to be accused and defend yourself. So put us in Cuomo's shoes and in his headspace. What is he doing right now?
Well, he's doing the best he can because everybody's abandoning him, his own party and the leaders of the Democratic Party. They've pretty much tested the political winds, and they've sensed that he's in very serious trouble, and they don't want to get anywhere near any of that. And so, therefore, they're all urging him to quit and to resign. It's a very lonely place to be. The allegations are very serious. They sure do look like they're truthful. And yet, he's entitled to due process and a presumption of innocence. He's denied these allegations, and so there should be some sort of a process that looks into whether or not those allegations are true or not. But I would say politically, he's in a whole bunch of trouble.
Yeah, I'm glad you edited yourself there, because it looked like you wanted to use a different word. But considering that he is in that lonely place, and you've been in that lonely place as well, when you knew that everybody, it seemed, in the world found you guilty, you were still maintaining your innocence. So for Cuomo, you know, again, I'm asking you to kind of give us that perspective as somebody at that high rank of governorship and say, you know, OK, I'm going to defend myself to the death. I'm going to go another round. I'm going to do this till, you know, till I have to quit. Is that the headspace that you think he is in?
Well, here's the question for him. And he knows the truth. He knows whether or not he did those things that way or whether it's not true. Now, he's saying it's not. If it's truly not true, then I think he has to take the position that he will not resign, that he will continue to fight for his reputation and for his good name and good behavior. Now, if he knows that he did it, then I think he needs to fess up and accept responsibility and do the necessary things to atone for what he did. Mm-hmm. In my case, to this very day, I insist none of those things that they said about me were crimes. In fact, you referenced in the very beginning so-called sale of the Senate seat. Well, that was a big lie. Told the day I was arrested on the 9th of December, 2008, it took 7 years for the appellate court to rule on that. And what they said was everything I said, which was it was routine political conversations. They were not crimes. It was what they called political log rolling. And those conversations were initiated by then President-elect Obama. And I learned a lot of hard lessons about how corrupt federal prosecutors can be and how broken the system is. And in the case of my impeachment, my case to move forward and take away the disqualifying provision in the law that was passed against me is predicated on the fact that the big lie is what set in motion that political chain of events that was foreseeable, that led to the rush to judgment. And within weeks, I was removed from office and out of a job.
Yeah,
and it was
swiftly.
Based on a big lie. And the appellate court eventually, as I said, 7 years later, ruled there was no sale of the Senate seat. That was, as I said, it was a lie.
Now, I have to ask you a couple of things about this, because you say that the impeachment proceedings were unconstitutional. What are you basing that on?
I'm basing it on the fact that they never proved up any crimes, and that the allegations were made about the so-called sale of the Senate seat at a super sensational press conference by the U.S. attorney, Mr. Fitzgerald, a very dishonest person, while I was locked up after they came to my house at 6 o'clock in the morning with SWAT teams. I'm a sitting governor of the fifth largest state in America. That's never happened before. All designed, by the way, to break my will to resist, to intimidate, and to make you say things they want you to say, and then they go easy on you. But I would never do it, and I fought back every step of the way. And well, they condemned me to prison after two trials for 14 years because of my defiance. Never took a penny. That was never about that. It was about those conversations. And ultimately, the centerpiece of their case was ruled legal. But to answer your question, my case, in terms of being able to try to run again, and I'm not seeking necessarily to run for any office. That's
right.
Not
you
what
haven't
this
decided.
Is about.
You haven't decided that you actually want to seek elected office. You just want to remove any roadblocks.
Yeah, and I want to begin the process, which is it's been a process that's been ongoing, of clearing my name and exposing the truth. That was a corrupt political hit job by a corrupt U.S. attorney.
But why? Why was it a hit job? Why were you such a target?
I also think the Democratic House Speaker, Mike Madigan, was part of this. I think he was working with the FBI agents, and I know that he orchestrated the impeachment process after I was arrested and the big lie was told. And that, too, is part of why I'm trying to undo what they did. Now, I'll never become the governor again that way if I'm successful in court, but I would like to, again, as I say, eliminate that disqualification provision that says I can't run for any state or local public office. Adrian, I can legally run for a seat in the United States Congress, but I can't run for a seat in the Cook County Cook County Board of Tax Appeals. I can run for president of the United States, but I can't run for local alderman here in Chicago. I'm not interested in running it for any of them necessarily, but the idea that it's sort of upside down that way, predicated on a big lie, this is what I'm fighting. And the larger issue is this. It's the weaponization and the politicization of the prosecutors and of the impeachment process. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter whether they do it to a Republican president or a Democrat governor. This kind of thing will steal from the people our right to choose our own leaders in free, fair, and honest elections. If the people want to vote against me, they ought to have a right to vote against me. And that's part of what my lawsuit's about. Mm-hmm. It's not about necessarily running for any particular office. It's about giving the right and the choice to the people, not a bunch of politicians.
One more time. I only have time for one more question in this segment.
Sure.
But during your sentencing, the judge actually said that he gave you a lighter sentence because you announced or gave some type of, you know, you were emotional and you said, you know, I was the governor. I should have known better. At least this is what I've seen reported from those court proceedings. Is that true? Were you admitting some responsibility in this case?
Well, I was, when you say emotional, I was stoic. I never whimpered or cried or, mm-hmm. you know, got down on my knees or begged him for anything.
But you did apologize.
Well, I apologized for misjudgments along the way. I acknowledge the fact that all those things I said on those tapes mm-hmm. were, in fact, things I said. Mm-hmm. But I also pointed out very clearly, I believed every bit of those things were on the right side of the line. And again, as I said, the appellate court vindicated me on the centerpiece of their case, the so-called sale of the Senate seat. That big lie to this day still sticks to me. I can't get rid of that. Winston Churchill said, a lie travels halfway around the world before the truth has a chance to put its pants on. And my pants right now are still about where my knees are. Mm-hmm. I'm still trying to clear my name on that big lie, and the court vindicated me. But yet people think, and you do, and your producers think, mm-hmm. that that's still legitimate, and it wasn't. And that's what this impeachment was about.
Well, I think that what we think is what we've seen in terms of the record, and this is what you were convicted of initially. And you, as you've mentioned and made very clear, the U.S. Appeals Court actually voided most of the charges against you that Illinois brought against you, correct?
The centerpiece of the case, the so-called sale of the Senate seat, the thing that I'm known for, was never a crime. And that happened in July of 2015, after I'd already spent something like 3-4 years in prison. Mm-hmm. You know, I was in the prison library leafing through the almanac one time, and I came across a photograph of me. I was looking to see how many gold records Elvis sold, and there I flipped on a photo of me, and it was about this. And it's this big photo, and it was 2013 almanac, and it's talking about the year before. Now I was sentenced to prison for 14 years for selling Obama's Senate seat. Mm-hmm. And again, that was never true, and the court vindicated me. But there it is in the almanac. And so to this day, as I said, I'm trying to put my pants on and get the truth out. And part of me trying to undo this law that prohibits only me from running for these state and public offices is about the right of the people to make the decisions, not politicians, but also me trying to set the record straight and clear my name.
A name is worth more than gold many times.
It's effing golden, to quote me.
You know what? We're probably going to hear that soundbite sometime tonight. stick around, Governor. We are going to have a little bit more and clarify some of the accusations, the comebacks, and what it means to be a Trumpocrat. Welcome back. My guest here in studio is former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich, the first and so far only Illinois governor to be impeached and removed from office. That removal and ban on holding future office is the subject of his brand new federal lawsuit. So you're suing the state of Illinois. You made that announcement this week. Why?
Because
why do you want to sue them when you don't even have a public office that you're really seeking?
Because the impeachment that removed me from office and the disqualifying provision that they passed is unconstitutional because it's the fruit of a poisonous tree, because it was based upon a big lie that ultimately was shown to be a big lie by the United States Appellate Court, that there was an attempt by me to sell President Obama's Senate seat. It never happened. That wasn't what it was. And I said it all along. And finally, in July of 2015, the appellate court agreed with me, and the impeachment was predicated on that, and therefore the whole thing should be ruled null and void. Now, I'm not asking to reinsert me as governor, but I am saying if I choose to run for an office in the state of Illinois, I should have that right to do it, and the people of Illinois should have a right to vote against me. Politicians shouldn't decide that. The people should decide that.
Well, let's listen to one of the infamous recordings from the wiretap that was used as evidence against you that eventually did get you impeached. Let's listen to this about being golden.
I've got this thing, and it's golden. And I'm just not giving it up for nothing.
What were you talking about?
Political horse trades, political deals. And I remember that vividly. This is effing golden. I'm not playing it. I'm not giving it up for nothing. I'm known for that now. What they don't do is they don't play the rest of the tape.
And is that was one of the reasons why you said this was unconstitutional, because you were not able to present the entire recording of that wiretap. It was only these certain segments, correct?
Correct. They selectively took snippets out of context that are embarrassing and make
you
look
bad. Why are they embarrassing?
Well, I mean, this is effing golden. You know, swearing on the telephone. I'm the governor of Illinois. Mm-hmm. It was only men on the phone, but, you know, it's not good language. But what they did was they twisted that to make it sound like I was trying to shake somebody down for money. Why didn't they play the rest of the tape? And they didn't, because they knew that was none of that. And it was just me talking to one of my political advisors. I just finished running 7.5-8 miles that day. I remember it was on like 1:30 in the afternoon. It was a Wednesday, the very day after the presidential election. President Obama sent an emissary to me to talk about making political deals for the candidate that he wanted for the United States Senate. And I said, should I just give him whoever he wants, or should we make a political deal? This is effing golden. I'm not going to give it up for nothing. We can get something. That had to be legal, of course. That it was the routine kind of stuff that happens in politics. It's what they call horse trading, log rolling.
And negotiating.
Yes, and you know, the president says, I'd like you to do X, and a congressman says, I would like some money for my congressional district.
It happens all the time.
All the time. And they criminalized it in my case, and they did to me what they did, and they set in motion that chain of events that led to my removal and ultimately my conviction and ultimately 8 years in prison.
Well, what about all the witnesses who say that they had evidence that they corroborated against you? What about the people who said they actually saw proof that you were corrupt?
Well, there was nobody that said any of those things in the trial. What they brought were witnesses who testified that they were on the telephone with me and that they had that conversation. And then he would ask them, well, what was your understanding of what that conversation is? You can't convict somebody based upon a third-party understanding. Did he or didn't he do the thing that was done? And that's the issue. And at the trials, they had two of them. They didn't convict me the first one on the corruption charges. What they did was they used rules that didn't give me a chance to, again, defend myself. Again, those tapes. If they had played those tapes and put the context, the case would have been dismissed long before for what's called insufficient evidence. Senator Menendez from New Jersey faced a second trial, and the judge intervened and saw that there were no elements that were required to prove a criminal case against the senator, and they threw the case out. And then he got reelected. He's a United States senator to this day. Mm-hmm. They didn't afford me the same fair treatment under the law. And that, again, is part of what I'm doing here with this attempt to undo that disqualifying provision.
Well, it's interesting because you've always been a Democrat, and now you've never renounced your party going through all of this, even though some of those who accused you were in your own party. Mm-hmm. You call yourself a Trumpocrat. Mm-hmm. What exactly is that? And obviously, we know that you were famously on The Apprentice with Donald Trump, former President Trump.
A Trumpocrat is a Democrat who supports President Trump. And I do for many reasons, but of course, how could you not support someone who saved your life and gave you a new beginning? I mean, I was literally like a guy in the middle of the North Atlantic in the wintertime, treading water for all those years, away from my family, condemned for things that are political, not criminal, and everybody's passing me by, in my own party, and here's this Republican president, who'd have imagined this, who actually pulls me out of that cold, dark North Atlantic and gives me a place where I can get a hot cup of coffee and get warm and
get
dry.
Back to your family.
Exactly.
I mean, commuting your sentence, it did shorten the time that you served behind bars. He said at the time that he thought that you were serving too severe of a sentence, or that you had served enough time, and that phone call, you said certain things that you shouldn't have said, and that it was all braggadocio. Do you agree with his statement? Were you talking a big game?
Well, I was... childish conversation. This is effing golden. I'm not giving it up for nothing. So I think he's essentially right about that. But again, it's a free country. You should have a right to be able to talk freely on the telephone. And unless there's really crimes, that's a different story. But these weren't. And the best proof of that is the fact that to this day, those prosecutors are blocking those tapes from being heard. I couldn't even play them in court. And there's a rule, an evidentiary rule that says the doctrine of completion. So if you take a small portion of a conversation, you're required to play the whole thing so people can hear the full context, but they didn't do it. And there's a line in one of the great poems by Rudyard Kipling. If you can bear to hear the truth you've spoken, twisted by knaves to make a trap for fools, and see the things you gave your life to broken, and stoop and build them up with worn-out tools. That's what they did to me. And they did it on some of the other stuff as well. And so what I'm doing now after all of that, in spite of everything that's happened, I consider myself blessed and lucky and fortunate that a Republican President Donald Trump did what he did, and how lucky I was that I actually did a show like Celebrity Apprentice, something I would never imagine myself doing when I was governor. I never watched it.
Right.
But I was in a position where I needed to earn some money for my family, and nobody was touching me back then because I was radioactive. And
well, you certainly are still one of the most, if not famous, infamous people on the planet. I have like 35 seconds. If you were to be governor again, what would you do about the violence that we're seeing across Chicago?
Well, that's where this governor is a big flop. He's failing. And he's sitting back because he doesn't want to take any political heat to do the hard things that are necessary to keep people safe. Black lives matter. And these Democrats talk a big game about that, but they won't do the hard things, like beefing up the police department, supporting the police officers. For every bad cop, there's 1,000 good ones. I've been the victim of bad cops. I would hire more police officers. I'd put them back on foot patrol. I would aggressively go after the gangbangers, who are the ones who are doing it, largely in black communities. 80% of the murders in Chicago and the shootings in Chicago are black people. And this would never be tolerated if it was happening in the neighborhoods where white people live. And this governor is running away from it because he wants to just leave the pressure on the mayor and let her take all the heat. She's not doing enough either. But he should do something about it, but he doesn't because he doesn't want to get himself bloodied up politically. They put politics over public safety, and it's immoral and it's sickening.
Well, thank you for your comments. Obviously, you have a very unique perspective considering all you've been through and what you have done prior to your term behind bars. But again, I know you have a lot coming up, and we are grateful that you made time for us. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Still to come, the 15-year court battle over James Brown's estate finally coming to an end. It divided his family. What took so long, and why did they reach an agreement now? Two of Brown's daughters join me next. Be happy after listening to that song. We feel good. Even my stage director bobbing his head along to the music right there. That's one of James Brown's iconic performances on the Ed Sullivan Show, the very definition of a music legend, the godfather of soul himself, and my own mother's favorite singer as a teenager. Now, his family can feel good, too, about finally settling his estate, a court battle that took nearly 15 years to decide. Brown died in 2006 at the age of 73, his estate torn between his children and the woman who he was last romantically linked to, Tommy Rae Heine. She is the mother of one of his children and claimed to be his wife, although a court ruled that their marriage, hers and Brown's, was invalid because she had failed to annul a previous marriage and was not entitled to his estate. But now, finally, it appears that both sides have reached a settlement or an agreement of some kind. We're joined by two of James Brown's daughters tonight, Ayama Brown and Deanna Brown Thomas. Thank you, thank you, thank you for being here. And I mean, really, what an honor to be able to carry on this legacy with music. I'm so happy for you. This battle is almost over. At least it feels like it is. How excited are you, or how thrilled are you that it's like finally?
It's a blessing to know that we could get through it, you know, and still be in one piece. It was a struggle, of course, but to stand for our rights and preserve his name and legacy was our goal. We continue to preserve his legacy through the James Brown Family Foundation, but to be able to stand up for what belonged to his heirs. And it was some ups and downs, but we made it through. You know, as I reflect back and thought about it, it was a long time. Most of it was in the process of fighting and showing that Tommy Rae Heine was not his legal wife. That took a lot of time, but we had to do what was right and what was necessary.
So what exactly, Yemma, I'll have you answer this, what exactly was agreed to?
Well, basically, as Deanna said, we did have to go through this process, and most of the time it was related to Tommy Rae's marriage, because, you know, that comes down to music publishing and ultimately who owns that and who owns this catalog. So for us, it was making sure we were able to legally show that she didn't have any rights to that. But when it comes to his estate, it's a little bit different. There are things that are owned by the estate. There's image and likeness, things that are outside of publishing. And so for us, it was coming to an agreement with the estate that there would be no more fighting, that, you know, now that we have finally got this last answer from the Supreme Court, for us, it was now we can move forward with the estate being able to do what that wanted it to do. And that's give money to charity so that children could go to college and that his own grandkids could go to college as well. So for us, it really is just solidifying what we already knew, but we couldn't go forward with that without making sure, like Deanna said, the rightful heirs were the ones that were going to, you know, ultimately be able to carry on that legacy.
And Deanna, was Tommy Rae Heine, was she putting that legacy in so much jeopardy that the money would not have gone to educational foundations for children in two particular states, right? Was it Georgia and another state? Remind me where?
South Carolina.
Okay. So was Tommy Rae Heine actually jeopardizing the use of those funds for what your father wanted them for?
And not only that, the jeopardizing our rights as heirs to his copyrights. And just legally, she was not his wife the day that he died, because when they married, she was still married to another man. And legally, we had to show that. We continue to do a lot of his charitable work that he did, giving away during the holidays to impoverished families, because he never forgot where he came from. Mm-hmm. Giving away food and toys and things for children, and we continue that through the foundation. And it's important to us, because it's important that we preserve his spirit as we know it.
Well, what we're going to do is we're going to take a short break, and we have more to come when we come back with the daughters of the legendary James Brown, including the time their father saved the city of Boston and possibly the entire nation from protests that could have been dangerous. We're talking about he was holding a concert for peace and unity without even knowing it. Stick around. A 15-year court battle over James Brown's estate is now settled. Two of his daughters, Yemma Brown and Deanna Brown Thomas, are with us tonight. Okay, so really quickly, I have to ask you about the last woman romantically linked to him. I was going to say his wife, but it was found that she was married to another person, and that is what nullified her from having a stake in his estate. But she and your father had a child together. James Brown Jr., I believe, is his name. Do you have a relationship with this young man? I mean, he's much younger than you. I want to say he's still a teenager, but have you spoken to him? What is your relationship like with him?
Well, I'll start off, because first of all, he is actually the same age as my son. Wow. Tommy Rae and I were both pregnant at the same time. So he definitely is part of our family. He is our youngest brother, and we love him dearly. I'll let Deanna talk a little bit more about Little Man, as we affectionately call him.
Yes, Little Man. And he's a young man now, because like you said, he's like 19.
Yeah, he's 20.
He's 20. So, right. So he is a young man. And but they live far away from us. I don't want to say where they live for privacy purposes. But we don't get to see him as often anymore.
Well, I hope that for the sake of the brothers and sisters, that you guys all do get to see each other one day as you reunite. As people grow older, sometimes things come into focus. But one thing that I do want to put in focus that might be very reflective for all of us is I want to play a video from the Boston concert that your father headlined. Let's listen to this back in 1968. That was the night after Martin Luther King Jr. was killed. Riots raged in cities across the country, but not in Boston where that concert was held. The local TV station, WGBH, aired James Brown's concert in its entirety that night to keep people at home. And really, it helped to broadcast at least some peace in uniting the country. You know, as I was thinking about it and as I was talking about it, this was not something that maybe your father understood in its broadness, but he did know that he had a great responsibility. Can you just quickly share about his sentiment from that evening?
Sure. Deanna, you want to mention the story with him and Mom?
Yeah,
I think it kind of sums it up pretty well.
He did. The night that he went to speak and to perform, he was very concerned about what he should say. And him and my mother had that conversation. She was pregnant with me at the time. And March of 68, as a matter of fact, in February of 68, she went to go stay with him. And the rest was history. She was pregnant with me. And he was very concerned about what to say, how to deliver things, because Dr. King was very important to Black America. He was important to the world at that point. And my dad had respect for him, his wife, his family, and he had respect for our people as well. He was a Black man. So he had to be concerned about what to say. And him and my mother had that conversation. She told him, just remember the words that you give, the words that you share, people are going to hang on to. Right after that, can't say it loud, I'm Black and I'm proud.
Famous words from a powerful man. And it really was a testament to the fact that some things can bring us together. So any last words from you, Yama? We only have about 30 seconds.
I just want to say that thank you very much for letting us come on here and really speak a little bit about this. But ultimately, we are just very, very thankful that all of this has been settled and we can get on to Dad's business at hand. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. He was a unique man, by many accounts, a complicated man, but he definitely has a legacy that will continue to live on. Yama Brown and Deanna Brown Thomas, thank you so much. And my thanks to all of you for joining us. We have got so much to talk about every single night this week. Again, let's go out with some James Brown music because it's appropriate. We're going to have more news tomorrow. Yeah, I was literally dancing before you guys came on, but we're going to have more news tomorrow night live at 10 p.m. Eastern. We want you to join us then, and maybe we'd be dancing again. We'll see. We should. Stay happy, y'all.